11. On his way to the infirmary to turn over to Kathy her supply of the drug, he found himself facing, unbelievably, the slumped, ill figure of Gino Molinari. In his wheelchair, the UN secretary sat with his heavy wool rug over his knees, his eyes writhing like separate living things, pinning Eric into immobility.
"Your CONAPT was bugged," Molinari said. "Your conversation with Hazeltine and Bacchus was picked up, recorded, and delivered in transcript form to me."
"So quickly?" Eric managed to say. Thank God he had made no reference to his own addiction.
"Get her out of here," Molinari moaned. "She's a star fink. She'll do anything, I know. This has happened before."
He was shaking.
"As a matter of fact, she's already out of here. My secret service men grabbed her and took her to the field, to a copter, so I don't know why I'm getting myself upset like this. Intellectually, I know the situation's in hand."
"If you have a transcript, you know that Miss Bacchus already arranged for Kathy to—"
"I know. All right."
Molinari panted for breath, his face unhealthy and raw, his skin hung in folds, dark, wrinkled wattles of loose flesh.
"See how Lilistar operates? Using our own drug against us. It's just like the bastards. Something they'd get a kick out of. We ought to drop it in their reservoirs. I let you in here, and then you let your wife in to obtain that crap, that miserable drug. She'd be willing to do anything. Assassinate me if they asked her to. I know everything there is to know about Frohedrin. I'm the one who thought up the name. From the German, froh, meaning joy, and the Latin, hida, the root for pleasure. Drin, of course."
He broke off, his swollen lips twitching.
"I'm too sick to get agitated like this. I'm supposed to be recovering from that operation. Are you trying to heal me or kill me, doctor? Or do you know?"
Eric said, "I don't know." He felt confused, numbed. This was just too much.
"You look bad. This is tough on you, even though, according to your security file and your own statements, you detest your wife, and she you. I guess you figure if you'd stayed with her, she wouldn't have become an addict. Listen, everyone has to live his own life. She has to take the responsibility. You didn't make her do it. She decided to do it. Does that help you? Feel any better?"
He scanned Eric's face for his reaction.
"I'll be okay," Eric said briefly.
"In a pig's ass. You look as bad as she does. I went down there to have a look at her. I couldn't resist. The poor goddamn dame. You already can make out the destruction caused by that stuff. And giving her a new liver and all new blood won't help. That's been tried before, as they told you."
"Did you talk to Kathy at all?"
"Me? Talk to a star fink?"
Molinari glared at him.
"Yes, I talked to her a little. While they were wheeling her out, I was curious to see what sort of woman you'd get mixed up with. You've got a masochistic streak 8 yards wide, and she proves it. She's a harpy, sweet scent. A monster, like you told me. You know what she said?"
He grinned.
"She told me you're an addict. Anything to cause trouble, right?"
"Right," Eric said stiffly.
"Why are you looking at me that way?"
Molinari regarded him, his black, fat eyes showing his regained control.
"It upsets you to hear that, doesn't it? To know she'd do everything possible to destroy your career here. Eric, if I thought you'd dabbled with that stuff, I wouldn't have you kicked out of here. I'd have you killed. During wartime, I kill people. It's my job. Just as you know and I know, because we discussed it, there may come a time not far from now when it'll be necessary for you to—"
He hesitated.
"What we said. Kill even me. Right, doctor?"
Eric said, "I have to give her the drug supply. May I go, secretary, before they take off?"
"No," Molinari said. "You can't go because there's something I want to ask you. Minister Frenexi is here still. You're aware of that. With his party in the East Wing in seclusion."
He held out his hand.
I want one capsule of JJ-180, Doctor. Give it to me, and then forget we had this talk. To himself, Eric thought, I know what you're going to do, or rather try to do, but you don't have a chance. This isn't the Renaissance.
I'm going to hand it to him personally, Molinari said, to see that it actually gets there and isn't drunk by some pimp along the way.
No, Eric said. I absolutely refuse.
Why?
Molinari cocked his head on one side. It's suicidal, for everyone on Terra.
You know how the Russians got rid of Beria? Beria carried a pistol into the Kremlin, which was against the law. He had it in his briefcase, and they stole his briefcase and shot him with his own pistol. You think matters at the top have to be complex? They're simple solutions average people always overlook. That's the main defect of the mass man.
Molinari broke off, put his hand suddenly to his chest.
Oh, my heart. I think it stopped. Oh, it's going now, but for a second there, nothing.
He had blanched, and his voice now ebbed to a whisper. I'll wheel you to your room. Eric stepped behind Molinari's wheelchair and began to push it. The mole did not protest, but sat slumped forward, massaging his fleshy chest, exploring and touching himself, with the tentativeness of disintegrating, overwhelming fear. Everything else was forgotten. He perceived nothing more than his sick, failing body. It had become his universe. With the assistance of two nurses, he managed to get Molinari back into bed.
Listen, sweet scent,
Molinari whispered as he lay back against the pillow.
I don't have to get that stuff through you. I can put pressure on Hazeltine and he'll deliver it right to me. Virgil Ackerman is a friend of mine. Virgil will see to it that Hazeltine complies. And don't try to tell me my job. You do yours and I'll do mine.
He shut his eyes and groaned.
Oh, God. I know an artery near my heart just burst. I can feel the blood leaking out. Get Teagarden in here!
Again he groaned and then turned his face to the wall.
What a day. Oh, but I'll get that Phrenexy yet.
All at once he opened his eyes and said,
I knew it was a stupid idea, but that's the kind of ideas I've been having lately. Dumb ideas like that. And what else can I do but that? Can you think of something else?
He waited.
No, because there isn't anything else, that's why.
Again, he shut his eyes.
Oh, I feel terrible. I think I really am dying this time, and you won't be able to save me.
I'll get Dr. Teagarden, Eric said, and started toward the door. Molinari said,
I know you're an addict, Doctor.
He drew himself up slightly.
I can almost invariably tell when someone is lying, and your wife wasn't. As soon as I saw you, I spotted it. You don't know how much you've changed.
After a pause, Eric said, What are you going to do?
We'll see, Doctor,
Molinari said, and again turned his face to the wall. As soon as he had completed the task of delivering the supply of JJ-180 to Kathy, he boarded an express ship for Detroit. 45 minutes later, he had reached the Detroit field and was on his way to Hazeltine Corporation by taxi. Gino Molinari, not the drug, had forced him to move this swiftly. He could not even wait until evening.
Here we are, sir,
the autonomic circuit of the cab said respectfully. It slid open its door so that he could emerge.
That gray one-story building with the hedge of rose-colored calyx with the whorl of green bracts at the base, that is Hazeltine Corporation.
Looking out, Eric saw the building, the lawn, and heather hedge. It wasn't a large structure, as industrial installations went. So this was the point at which JJ-180 had entered the world.
Wait, he instructed the cab. Do you have a glass of water? Certainly.
From the slot facing Eric, a paper cup of water slid forward, teetered on the lip of the slot, and then halted. Seated in the cab, Eric swallowed the capsule of JJ-180, which he had brought with him, purloined from Kathy's stock. Several minutes passed.
Why aren't you getting out, sir?
The cab inquired.
Have I done something wrong?
Eric waited. When he felt the drug begin to reach him, he paid the cab, got out, and walked slowly up the redwood round path toward the office of Hazeltine Corporation. The building flashed as if caught by a whip of lightning, and overhead the sky twisted laterally. He saw, gazing up, the clear blue of day dawdle as if attempting to remain and then collapse. He shut his eyes because the dizziness was too great. The reference point of outside objects had become too tenuous, and he walked step by step, feeling his way ahead, bent down, for some reason motivated to continue in motion, however slow. It hurt. This, unlike the initial exposure, was a major readjustment of the reality structure impinging on him. His steps made no sound, he noticed. He had strayed onto the lawn, but he still kept his eyes shut. Hallucination, he thought, of another world. Is Hazeltine right? By a paradox, perhaps I can answer that within the hallucination itself, if that is what it is. He didn't think so. Hazeltine was wrong. When a heather branch brushed his arm, he let his eyes open. One of his feet had penetrated the soft black soil of a flower bed. He rested on a half-crushed tuberous begonia. Past the heather hedge, the gray side of Hazeltine Corporation rose, exactly as before, and above it, the sky was a washed-out blue with irregular clouds sweeping toward the north. The same sky, as nearly as he could tell. What had changed? He returned to the redwood round path. Shall I go in? He asked himself. He looked back toward the street. The cab had gone. Detroit, the buildings and ramps of the city, seemed somehow elaborate, but he did not know this area. When he reached the porch, the door flew open automatically for him, and he looked in on a neat office with relaxing, leather-covered chairs, magazines, a deep-pile carpet whose design changed continuously. He saw, through an open doorway, a business area, accounting machines and a computer of some ordinary kind, and at the same time he heard the buzz of activity beyond that, from the labs themselves. As he started to sit down, a four-armed Rig walked into the office, its blue, chitinous face inexpressive, its embryonic wings pressed tightly to its sloping, bullet-shiny back. It whistled a greeting to him. He had not heard that about them, and passed on out through the doorway. Another Rig, manipulating its extensive network of double-jointed arms vigorously, made its appearance, traveled up to Eric's sweet scent, halted, and produced a small square box. Scudding across the side of the box, words in English took shape and departed. He woke to the fact that he had to pay attention to them. The Rig was communicating with him. Welcome to Hazeltine Corporation. He read the words but did not know what to do with them. This was a receptionist. He saw that the Rig was a female. How did he reply? The Rig waited, buzzing. Its structure was so convoluted that it seemed unable to remain entirely still. Its multi-lensed eyes shrank and grew as they were partially absorbed back into the skull, then pushed out like flattened corks. If he hadn't known better, he would have said it was blind. And then he realized that these were its false eyes, the genuine ones, compound, were at its top arm elbows. He said, "May I speak to one of your chemists?" And he thought, "So we did lose the war." To these things, and now Terra is occupied, and its industries are run by these. But, he thought, human beings still exist, because this Rig was not dumbfounded to see me. It has accepted my presence as natural. So we can't be mere slaves either. Regarding what matter? Hesitating, he said, "A drug, produced here in the past, called either Frohedidrin or JJ-180, both names refer to the same product. Just a moment, please." The female Rig scuttled through the inner doorway to the business office, then disappeared entirely. He stood waiting, thinking to himself that if this was a hallucination, it certainly was not a voluntary one. A larger Rig, a male, appeared. Its joints seemed stiff, and Eric realized that it was old. They had a short lifespan, measured in terms of months, not years. This one had almost come to the end of his. Utilizing the translating box, the elderly male Rig said, "What is your inquiry about JJ-180? Please be brief." Eric bent, picked up a magazine that lay on a table nearby. It was not in English. The cover bore a picture of two Reegs, and the writing consisted of the crabbed, pictorial Reegian script. Startled, he stared at it. The magazine was life. Somehow it shocked him more than the actual sight of the enemy itself. The elderly Reeg rattled with impatience. Eric said, "I want to purchase an antidote to the addictive drug JJ-180 in order to break my addiction." "You did not need me for that. The receptionist could have taken care of you." Turning, the elderly Reeg scrabbled haltingly off, eager to return to his work. Eric was left alone. The receptionist returned with a small brown paper bag. She held it out to him, not with a jointed arm, but with a mandible. Eric accepted it, opened it, and looked inside. A bottle of pills. This was it. There was nothing more to be done. "That will be $4.35, sir." The receptionist watched as he got out his wallet. He took a $5 bill from it and passed it to her. "I am sorry, sir. This is outdated wartime currency, no longer in use." "You can't take it?" he said. "We have a rule forbidding us to." "I see," he said numbly and wondered what to do. He could gulp down the contents of the bottle before she could stop him, but then he would probably be arrested, and the rest he could visualize in an instant. Once their police had examined his identification, they would know that he came from the past, and they would be aware that he might carry back information affecting the outcome, which had obviously been favorable for them, of the war. And they couldn't afford that. They would have to murder him, even if the two races now lived in concert. "My watch," he said. He unfastened it from his wrist, passed it to the female Reeg. 17-joule, 70-year battery. On inspiration, he added, "An antique, perfectly preserved, from pre-war days." "Just a moment, sir." Accepting the watch, the receptionist made her way on her long, yielding legs to the business office, conferred with someone invisible to Eric. He waited, making no attempt to devour the pills. He felt trapped in a membrane of crushing density, unable to act or escape from action, caught in a halfway land between. From the business office, something emerged. He looked up. It was a human, a man, young, with close-cropped hair, wearing a work smock that was stained and rumpled. "What's the trouble, buddy?" the man asked. Behind him, the Reeg receptionist followed, her joints clacking. Eric said, "Sorry to bother you. Could you and I talk in private?" The man shrugged. "Sure." He led Eric from the room and into what appeared to be a storage chamber, shutting the door. The man turned to him placidly and said, "That watch is worth $300. She doesn't know what to do with it. She's only got a 600 type brain. You know how the D-class is." He lit a cigarette, offered the pack, Camels, to Eric. "I'm a time traveler," Eric said as he took a cigarette. "Sure you are." The man laughed. He extended his match to Eric. "Don't you know the action of JJ-180? It was made right here." After a thoughtful pause, the man said, "But not for years, because of its addictive qualities and its toxicity. In fact, there hasn't been any since the war."
"They won the war?"
"They? Who's that?"
"The Reegs," Eric said.
"The Reegs," the man said, "is us, not they. They was Lilistar. If you're a time traveler, you ought to know that even better than I."
"The Pact of Peace."
"There was no pact of peace. Listen, buddy, I minored in world history in college. I was going to teach. I know all about the last war. It was my specialty. Gino Molinari, he was UN secretary then just before hostilities broke out, signed the Era of Common Understanding protocols with the Reegs. And then the Reegs and the Starmen started fighting, and Molinari brought us in on the Reeg side because of the protocols, and we won."
He smiled.
"And this stuff you say you're hooked on, it was a weapon that Hazeltine Corp developed in 2055 during the war for use against Lilistar. And it didn't work out because the Phrenexites were advanced even over us in pharmacology and, you know, quickly worked out an antidote. Which antidote you're attempting to buy. God, they had to develop it. We got the snunk into their drinking water? That was the Mole's idea himself," he explained. "That was Molinari's nickname."
"All right," Eric said. "Let's just leave it at this. I want to buy the antidote. I want to trade that watch. It is satisfactory?" He still held the brown paper bag.
Reaching into it, he lifted out the bottle. Get me some water and let me take it, and then let me get out of here. I don't know how long it'll take before I go back to my own time. Is there any objection to that? He had difficulty controlling his voice. It tried to rise and escape, and he was shaking, but he did not know with what. Anger? Possibly fear? More likely bewilderment. At this point, he did not even know if he were bewildered. Calm down. Cigarette jutting from his lips, the man walked off, evidently in search of water.
Can you take him with a Coke?
Yes, Eric said. The man returned with a half-empty bottle of Coca-Cola and watched as Eric struggled to get the pills down one after another. At the door, the female Rig receptionist appeared. Is he all right?
Yeah,
the man said as Eric managed to wash down the last pill. Will you take charge of the watch? Accepting it from her, the man said,
Of course it's company property. That goes without saying.
He started out of the storeroom. Was there ever a UN secretary near the end of the war named Donald Festenberg? Eric said.
No,
the man said. He should receive some cash settlement for the watch in addition to the medication. The flashing box declaring its message was extended by the female Rig toward the man. He halted, frowning, then shrugged.
100 in cash, he said to Eric. Take it or leave it, it's all the same to me.
I'll take it, Eric said, and followed him to the business office. As the man counted out the money in odd, unfamiliar bills which Eric had never seen the like of, he thought of another question. How did Gino Molinari end his term in office? The man glanced up.
Assassinated.
Shot?
Yeah, by old-fashioned lead slugs. A fanatic got him. Because of his lenient immigration policy, his letting the Rigs settle here on Terra. There was a racist faction, scared about polluting the blood. As if Rigs and humans could interbreed.
He laughed. This, then, Eric thought, may be the world from which Molinari got that bullet-riddled corpse which Festenberg showed me. The dead Gino Molinari lying mangled and blood-spattered in his helium-filled casket. From behind him, a dry, matter-of-fact voice said, Are you not going to make the attempt, Dr. Sweetscent, to take the antidote for JJ-180 back to your wife? It was an organism without eyes entirely, and he thought, seeing it, of fruit he had come onto as a child, overripe pears lying in the weedy grass, covered by a crawling layer of yellow jackets attracted by the sweet odor of rot. The creature was vaguely spherical. It had fitted itself into a harness, however, which had squeezed its soft body torturously. No doubt it needed this in order to get around in the Terran environment, but he wondered why it was worth it to the thing.
Is he really a time traveler?
The man at the cash register asked, jerking his head at Eric. The spherical organism, wedged within its plastic harness, said by means of its mechanical audio system, Yes, Mr. Taubman, he is. It floated toward Eric, then halted a foot above the ground, making an indistinct sucking noise, as if pulling fluids through its artificial tubes.
This guy,
Taubman said to Eric, indicating the spherical organism,
is from Beetlejuice. His name is Willie Kay. He's one of our best chemists.
He shut the register.
He's a telepath. They all are. They get a kick out of prying into our minds and the Rigs, but they're harmless. We like them.
He walked over to Willie Kay, bent toward him, and said,
Listen, if he's a time traveler, I mean, we can't let him just walk out of here. Isn't he dangerous or worse something? Shouldn't we at least call in the city police? I thought he was nuts or kidding me.
Willie Kay floated a little closer to Eric, then withdrew. There is no way we can keep him here, Mr. Taubman. When the drug wears off, he will go back to his own period. However, I would like to interrogate him to a certain extent while he's here. To Eric, he said, Unless you object, sir.
I don't know, Eric said, rubbing his forehead.
It had been too much of the unexpected. Hearing Willie Kay ask about Kathy, it had disoriented him entirely, and all he wanted to do now was leave. He had no curiosity, no interest in the situation. I sympathize with your situation, Willie Kay said. In any case, to question you formally is sham. I am getting everything I want from you as it is. What I had hoped to do was answer, if I could, some of your questions by the way I phrased mine. Your wife, for example. You have great conflicting emotions about her. Fear, for the most part, then hatred, and also a good deal of undistorted love.
Taubman said, God, how the Beatles love to be psychologists. It must come natural to telepaths. I don't think they can even help it.
He loitered nearby, evidently interested in Willie Kay's probing. Can I take the antidote back to Kathy? No, but you can memorize the formula, Willie Kay said. So the Hazeltine Corporation, in your time, can reproduce it. But I don't think you want to. I'm not going to urge you to, and I can't force you to.
You mean his wife's hooked on JJ-182?
Taubman said.
And he isn't going to try to help her?
You're not married, Willie Kay said. In marriage, the greatest hatred that is possible between human beings can be generated, perhaps because of the constant proximity, perhaps because once there was love. The intimacy is still there, even though the love element has disappeared. So a will to power, a struggle for domination, comes into being. To Taubman, he explained, it was his wife Kathy who addicted him in the first place, so it is easy to understand his sentiments.
Oh, I hope I never get in a fix like that, Taubman said, hating someone I once loved.
The female Rieg had clacked up to listen, watching the conversation as it was reproduced on the surface of her translating box. Now she added her own comment. Hate and love are closely linked, much more so than most Terrans realize.
Do you have another cigarette? Eric asked Taubman. Sure,
Taubman passed him the pack. What I find most interesting of all, Willie Kay said, is that Dr. Sweetscent comes from a universe in which a pact exists between Terra and Lilistar, and that in his year, 2055, a war is being fought in which they are slowly but steadily losing. Clearly, this is not our past, but another past entirely. And in his mind, I find the excruciatingly interesting thought that Terra's quondam warlord, Gino Molinari, has already discovered this rank of parallel universes and has made use of it for his immediate political advantage.
Willie Kay was silent a moment and then declared,
No, Dr. Sweetscent. After having visualized your memory of the Molinari corpse, I am fairly certain that it was not obtained from our world. True, Molinari died by assassination, but I recall pics of his corpse, and there is a small but crucial difference. In our world, the secretary was hit repeatedly in the facial area. His features were destroyed. The corpse you saw was not so damaged, and I would assume it comes from another world in which he was assassinated, similar to ours, but not identical.
This must be why so few time travelers have shown up here, Taubman said. They're scattered through all the different possible futures.
As to the virile Molinari, Willie Kay said thoughtfully, I suppose that too is an alternate configuration. You realize, of course, Doctor, that all this indicates that your secretary has taken JJ-180 himself. There is therefore an element of cruel hypocrisy in his threatening you with death if you became addicted. But I would guess, by several clues in your mind, that he also possesses the star-manufactured antidote which you just now took. So he has no fears and can move freely about among the worlds.
The mole, Eric realized, could have given me and Kathy the antidote any time.
It was hard for him to accept that about Gino Molinari. He had seemed more humane than this. He was just playing with us, Eric realized, as Willie Kay said, with an element of cruel hypocrisy. But wait, Willie Kay cautioned. We don't know what he intended to do. He had just found out about your addiction, and he was as usual suffering from a spasm of his chronic illness pattern. He might have given it to you in time, before it ceased to matter.
Could you explain this discussion?
The Rieg receptionist and also Taubman had lost the thread of the discourse. Would you care to begin the laborious process of memorizing the formula? Willie Kay said to Eric. It will take all the time you have left.
All right, Eric said, and listened intently.
Wait. Willie Kay ceased, rotated his supporting mechanism inquiringly. The doctor has learned something more important than any chemical formula.
What is it? Eric asked her.
In your universe, we are your enemy, but here you have seen Terrans and ourselves live together. You know that war against us is unnecessary, and what is more important, so does your leader. That was so. No wonder Molinari had no heart for the war. It was not merely a suspicion on his part that this was the wrong war with the wrong enemy and the wrong ally. It was a fact which he had experienced for himself, perhaps many times, and all due to JJ-180. But not only that, there was something more, something so ominous that he wondered why the inhibition barriers of his mind had permitted the thought to rise from his unconscious. JJ-180 had reached Lilistar, and in quantity, Starmen had certainly been experimenting with it. So they too knew the alternate possibility, knew that Terra's better hope lay in cooperation with the Reegs, had witnessed it for themselves. In both branches of possibility, Lilistar had lost the war, with or without Terra on her side. Or was there a third alternative? One in which Lilistar and the Reegs joined against Terra? A pact between Lilistar and the Reegs is unlikely, Willie Kay said. They have been antagonists for too many years. I feel that it is only your planet, on which we now stand, that hangs in the balance. Lilistar will be defeated by the Reeg power in any eventuality. But that means, Eric said, that the Starmen have nothing to lose. If they know they can't win... He could imagine Phrenexi's reaction to this information. The nihilism, the destructive violence of the Starmen would be inconceivable. True, Willie Kay agreed. So your secretary is wise to walk softly. Now perhaps you can comprehend why his illness pattern must be so vast, why he must push himself actually over the brink into repeated death to serve his people, and why he would hesitate to provide you with the antidote to JJ-180, if Star intelligence agents, and your wife may be one, learned that he possessed it, they might. Willie Kay was silent. It is hard, as you yourself might observe, to predict the behavior of psychotics. But this much is clear. They would not ignore the situation.
They'd find a way to get it away from him, Eric said.
You've missed the point. Their attitude would be punitive. They would know that Molinari possesses too much power, that by having unhindered use of JJ-180, without the possibility of addiction, of neural deterioration, he can't be controlled by them. This is why, on a deep, psychosomatic basis, Molinari can defy Minister Phrenexi. He is not entirely helpless.
This is all over my head, Taubman said. Excuse me.
He walked off. The Reeg receptionist remained. Urge your secretary to contact the Reeg authority. We would assist in protecting Terra from Star vengeance, I am sure.
It was, Eric thought, a rather wistful message which the multi-armed creature had flashed at him with her translation box. The Reegs might want to assist, but Starmen were already on Terra holding key positions. At the first hint that Terra was negotiating with the Reegs, the Starmen would move in prearranged order. They would seize the planet overnight. A tiny Terran-controlled state might function for a limited time in the Cheyenne vicinity, shelled and bombed day and night by the Starmen. But then it, too, would capitulate. Its shield of Jupiter-obtained Rexoroid compounds would not protect it forever, and Molinari knew that. Terra would become a conquered state, supplying war material and slave labor to Lilistar, and the war would go on. And the irony was this. As a slave planet, Terra would be able to contribute more to the war effort than she did now as a quasi-independent entity. And no one recognized this more than did the Mole, hence his entire foreign policy. This explained everything that he did.
By the way, Willie Kay said, and there was a trace of amusement in his voice, your former employer, Virgil Ackerman, is still alive. He still governs Tijuana Fur and I. He is 230 years old and retains 20 org-trans surgeons within call. I believe I have read that he has gone through 4 matched sets of kidneys, 5 livers, spleens, and undetermined numbers of hearts.
I feel sick, Eric said and rocked back and forth.
The drug is wearing off. Willie Kay floated toward a chair. Miss Sieg, assist him, please.
I'm okay,
Eric said thickly. His head ached and nausea staggered him. All the lines, the surfaces around him, had become astigmatic. Under him, the chair felt unreal, and then, abruptly, he fell, lay on his side.
The transition is difficult, Willie Kay said. Apparently, we can't help him, Miss Sieg. Good luck to your secretary, Doctor. I can appreciate what a great service he performed for your people. Perhaps I will write a letter to the New York Times conveying this knowledge.
A prism of primal colors tapped at Eric like an illuminated wind. It was, he thought, the wind of life blowing over him, sweeping him where it desired without regard for his small wishes. And then the winds became black. They were no longer the winds of life, but the opaque smoke of death. He saw, projected as a pseudo-environment around him, a travesty of his injured nervous system. The multitudes of conduits were visibly corrupted, had turned inky as the drug's damage spread throughout him and established its grim self. A voiceless bird, some carrion eater of the storm, sat on his chest, croaking in the silence left behind as the winds receded from him. The bird remained, and he felt its dung-like claws penetrate his lungs, his chest cavity, and then his abdominal cavity. Nothing within him remained untouched. It had all been disfigured, and even the antidote had not stopped this. As long as he lived, he would never regain the purity of the original organism. This was the price exacted from him by the deciding forces. Dragging himself to a crouched position, he saw that he inhabited an empty waiting room. No one had seen him, and he was free to get up and go. He rose to his feet, steadied himself by means of a chrome and leather chair. The magazines in the nearby rack were in English, and their covers, Laughing Terrans, not Riggs.
Did you want something?
A male voice, lisping slightly, a Hazeltine employee wearing florid, fashionable robes. No, Eric said. This was his own time. He recognized the trappings of 2055. Thanks just the same. A moment later, he had made his way painfully outdoors in the direction of the sidewalk, down the path of Redwood Rounds. What he wanted was a cab, a place to sit down and rest as he made his trip back to Cheyenne. He had gotten what he wanted. Presumably, he was no longer an addict, and if he cared, he could also free his wife. And in addition, he had viewed a world over which the shadow of Lilistar did not obtain.
Ferry you somewhere, sir?
An autonomic cab drifted toward him. Yes, he said, and walked toward it. Suppose an entire planet took the drug, he thought as he boarded. A mass fugue away from our dismal, ever-narrowing world of reality. Suppose Tijuana Furundi gave the order to produce it in enormous quantity, distributed it, through the government's help, to everyone. Would that be a moral solution? Are we entitled to that? Anyhow, it couldn't be done. The Starmen would move in first.
Where to, sir?
The cab circuit inquired. He decided to use it for the entire trip. It would take only a few minutes longer. To Cheyenne.
I can't, sir. Not there.
It sounded nervous.
Request another.
Why not? He came awake instantly.
Because, as is well known, all Cheyenne belongs to them, to the enemy, it added, and traffic into enemy areas is illegal, as you know.
What enemy?
The traitor Gino Molinari, the cap answered, who sought to betray the war effort. You know, sir, the former UN secretary who conspired with Rieg agents to...
What is the date? Eric demanded.
June 15, 2056.
He had, possibly through the action of the antidote, failed to make it to his own time. It was 1 year later, and there was nothing he could do about it. And he had saved out no more of the drug. The rest had been given to Kathy at the airfield, and so he was stuck here in what obviously was star-dominated territory, like most of Terra. And yet Gino Molinari was alive. He still hung on. Cheyenne had not fallen in a day or a week. Perhaps the Riggs had been able to bring in reinforcements to assist the Secret Service. He could find out from the cab as they flew along. And Don Festenberg could have told me this, he realized, because this is precisely the time period at which I encountered him there in his office with the phony homeopape and mock-up UN secretary uniform. Just head west, he told the cab. I've got to get back to Cheyenne, he realized, somehow, by some route.
Yes, sir, the cab said. And by the way, sir, you failed to show me your travel permit. May I see it now? Just a formality, of course.
What travel permit? But he knew. It would be an issue of the governing Star Occupation Agency, and without their permission, Terrans could not come and go. This was a conquered planet and very much still at war.
Please, sir, the cab said. It had begun to descend once more. Otherwise, I am required to carry you to the nearest Star Military Police Barracks. That is 1 mile east, a short trip from here.
I'll bet it is, Eric agreed. From any point, not just from here. I'll bet they're all over.
The cab dropped lower and lower.
Right you are, sir. They're very convenient.
It clicked off its engine and coasted.